You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Now it's time to get global. Here's the international desk with Lisa and myself interrupting every so often.
Today we are only actually going to focus on one thing and one country for a rather unhappy and funny piece of news. We're talking about Rwanda and more precisely the commemoration of the 25th anniversary of the genocide of the Tutsi people in Rwanda. For those of you who might not be aware of it, on April 7th, 1994, the systematic slaughter of part of the country's population began, and it led to the death of at least 800,000 Tutsi, which is an ethnic group in Rwanda. Those numbers are according to the United Nations. It could be more. This genocide actually only spread across 3 months. It was just 100 days, but it's responsible for the loss of 70% of this minority ethnic group in Rwanda, which I think goes to show the level of violence that was experienced in that very brief time. So like I said, it was April 7th, so the commemoration happened over the weekend. And I think to explain a little bit how we experienced such a high level of violence so briefly, we need to look back at the roots of the conflict. I'd like to look at the pre-colonial era to begin with, and just maybe do a little bit of, look at the ethnicities in Rwanda. There's three ethnic groups, basically, that have established on the territory. There's the Twa people, who are Aboriginal Pygmy people, and then you have two Bantu people. So Bantu is a sub-Saharan ethnic group. You've got the Hutu, who represent the majority of the people, and you've got the Tutsi, who back in 1994 represented about 15% of the global population of Rwanda.
Yeah, so Hutu is the largest, then Tutsi is the middle, and then Twa smallest.
Exactly. Like I said, both Hutu and Tutsi are part of the Bantu people, so they share high genetic similarities, and they also intermarried a lot. So the distinctions between those two groups of people are actually very, very minor. But what happened in pre-colonial Rwanda is that first there was kind of villages and then kingdoms, and then the Kingdom of Rwanda was founded, I think, in 1700. What happened is that there was the emergence of a Tutsi elite that kind of overtook the kingdom's administrative roles and high-ranked roles. But the Hutu group was still the majority in terms of numbers, but was not exactly part of the elite, except for the very rich ones. So that's kind of what we had before the colonial era. And then in 1884, the Germans arrived in Rwanda. They kept the monarchy in place, so they had more of like a slightly administrative role, but they decided to favour the Tutsi people over the Hutu people for those administrative roles, because they believed for some reason that the Tutsi people came from Ethiopia because of their facial features, I think, and they kind of believed them to be of a higher race, so they just decided that the Tutsi people would be favoured. Then Belgium arrives in the picture, takes over Rwanda during World War One. In 1926, Belgium has more of a direct colonial rule over the country. And in 1935, there's the introduction of ID cards that clearly label people's ethnic groups. And that played a major part in the events that would unfold afterwards. Because before that, you could be a very rich, wealthy Hutu, and you kind of would become some sort of like a honorary Tutsi of some sort. I don't know. There was kind of like, you know, so your wealth would make you part of the elite.
So there's kind of some social hierarchy as well between these ethnic groups. So And I would assume that the identification cards would further kind of divide these and kind of almost create a more of a hierarchy or more of a structure.
Yeah, then it kind of became almost like a caste system.
Right. Yeah.
And it just really forged people's identity. It just really separated people into set communities. Mm. Whereas I think before, especially with intermarriages, you had much more exchanges between those communities.
Right.
But then with the ID cards and this label being put on people, there was really a separation that occurred.
Kind of similar practice, dare I say it, to what Mussolini introduced in Italy with an ID card system, creating a caste system amongst kind of a social hierarchy.
Yes, so quite big responsibility, I think, of Belgium at that time, and in sort of high heightening ethnic tensions between the Rwandan communities. And after World War II, there is the Hutu people start, striving for emancipation. Also, you have Catholic missionaries that come onto the territory.
Yeah.
And what they do is that they kind of choose to support the underprivileged Hutu.
Yeah,
they support them, and you have the construction of the development of a Hutu clergy and more education and the development of a Hutu elite as well, who is kind of more eager for emancipation and has the means to have their voices heard more so than before.
Were there any religious differences prior between the Hutu and the Tutsi?
No, the culture is very, very similar, actually, and they have, the basically, it was settlements from sub-Saharan regions, but they share, that kind of came from the same area, and everything was sort of very similar.
So this would
similar.
Just be another kind of divisive thing that would heighten cultural tensions between the two groups on behalf of kind of the Belgian and clergy who were there at the time.
Yeah, because basically Western powers came and sort of decided to highlight the differences between the people rather than what made them so similar.
Right.
And I think that and by giving them different roles and different rights based on that really heightened the tensions. So we've got this Hutu elite that starts forming and asks for emancipation. The Belgian administration was really favouring the Tutsi, but then they kind of decide that they've had enough. And they support Hutu killings of elite and civilian Tutsi, and that's at the end of the 50s. That's what was called the Rwandan Revolution. And in 1960, the king is deposed. In 1962, Rwanda gains independence and a Hutu-dominated republic is created.
Right, so that was alongside the independence of Burundi as well.
Yes.
Because
Belgium, I think, had both, so it kind of happened at the same time. And so we kind of shift from a Tutsi-dominated country to a Hutu-dominated country, I suppose, in terms of who holds the power. And so you start seeing purges of Tutsi people who are forced to exile in other neighbouring countries.
Right.
So we've got Burundi, Uganda, Tanzania, and then what was Zaire, which also belonged to Belgium, Congo. But these people that were in exile were kind of considered refugees in those areas, not settlers anymore.
Right.
And so they have this desire to come back, obviously, to their country of origin. And so they try to create armed force groups, but it doesn't really work in terms of the attack they're deciding to launch. And also there's retaliation, obviously, for those offensive. And so that causes the death of about 10,000 Tutsi people in 1963. And according to figures that I have looked at, there's more than 300,000 Tutsi that had fled Rwanda by 1964.
So how did we get to the genocide from there?
So all of these people, all of these Tutsis that were forced to exile, decided basically in the early 90s to try and come back to the country. And so there's the creation of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is made out of Tutsi rebels that were outside of Rwanda. And they start an offensive on Rwandan territory in 1990. And, okay, if I want to make it quick, because we don't actually have a lot of time, what happens is that that created further tensions, and there was a fear of the Tutsis from, like, the majority Hutu population, which the government and Hutu extremists kind of helped spread at that time through lots of propaganda, creation of radio stations that would basically be inciting hatred, and that was really bad. And then on the 6th of April 1994, the Hutu president of Rwanda, who's on a plane, is killed because this plane is shot down. And basically the Hutu extremists and those in government decide to blame it on the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Never really been proved. And that creates big tensions. And what happens is that it happens really, really fast. On that night, the president is killed. The kind of rest of the moderate people that were in government or in position to be in line in the new government are being killed. And on the next day, the 7th of April 1994, the genocide basically starts straight away. And the reason it was able to spread so fast was because, well, first off, there had been all of that propaganda and people were kind of afraid. But also the extremists knew that they couldn't annihilate an entire people by themselves, so they really relied on the civilians to do that. And they relied on civilians' ability to know who was a Hutu and who was a Tutsi. And they would know that because they were their friends, they were their, you know, their family. They were, so it was really easy for them to have access to that information and therefore kill people that they had around them. And also for those who, you know, in the city, for instance, where people are a bit more anonymous and you don't necessarily know who is what, they would make road blockades. You had to show your ID card, and obviously your ID card would then say who you were, and if you were found to be a Tutsi, then you would literally just be shot on sight.
From what I understand as well, the kind of perpetration of this violence was kind of further facilitated by the kind of political elite who were mainly Hutu, which meant that there was also kind of quite high levels of control in the gendarmerie and the government-backed military or violence-based forces, which would kind of legitimize those road blockades.
And so like I said, at least 800,000 people were killed in about 100 days. It mainly happened in the first month, all these killings. It led to 70% of the Tutsi population being decimated. And what happened as well is that rape was kind of a weapon of choice against women and their descendants. That there's about, according to figures again, 250,000 women that were raped at that time. A lot of lost all of their families, and then they had to give birth to a child afterwards. There's lots of HIV infections as well following that. We're counting about 20,000 children born as a result of rape in that area, and it's been really hard for women really to, you know, you've lost your entire family obviously, and then after that you have to face the result.
I think this is an incredibly important thing to remember as well as we look at the anniversary. This anniversary isn't of something that happened 25 years ago. It's something that is still lasting today. And this is a kind of memorial of the fact that it is still happening today and people are still living with the consequences of this.
Yeah, and if people are interested in that part, there's a German NGO that actually made a book called Rwandan Daughters, and it's a book of photographs. And it's photographs of mothers and their daughters or sons who survived the genocide and were born after after following a rape of their parents. And they kind of discuss how they feel, which is very poignant. Just a little thing on kind of the aftermath as well. One thing that's interesting is that basically Rwanda's now being praised for its economic growth. It's, according to figures, looking really good, you know, 7% annual growth, GDP that grew by more than 120% over two decades. It's a really easy place to do business in Africa. It's really well developed in terms of technology. All of that is very impressive, I suppose. They also have great public services, but there's questions about how that was achieved through reconciliation after the genocide, which was kind of forced upon people. The idea was that basically, how do I finish that quickly? People weren't really given a choice. They were given they kind of had to, through that, okay, there was this thing which is community work called Humunga, Humuganda, which is coming together in a common purpose, which is like a big clean out day where people are actually forced to work together to clean out the streets and all of that, but it's compulsory. If you don't do it, you can get fined, all of that. But it kind of forced people to work together with people that may have killed their entire family, sort of, and just do that. And that's, a lot of people credit that as a way to rebuild the nation, I suppose. But it's kind of...
It kind of papers over these cracks as well, and rather than actually fixing them.
Yeah, there hasn't really been, like, justice inside the country hasn't really been done. Like, there's the international...
There's been a lot of accords and stuff as well afterwards, however.
And there's the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda that was set into place with like 95 people indicted. But
I'm going to have to be very horrible, and thank you for teaching us a lot today.
But for those who are interested in Rwanda, there's lots of articles, obviously, that have been published recently that you can look at for more information. But also it's important to look into Paul Kagame, who is the current president, a very autocratic president at the moment. And yeah, his role in all of that is quite interesting as well. So
thank you very much, Lisa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.